Ask an Astronomer Time, and this episode we have Dr. Edward Boyce from the Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics answering your questions. So thank you very much again for coming along and answering questions.
Thank you, Nick. It's good to be doing this again.
First question is from Tom Hudson, and he writes, if Jupiter can be a stronger radio source than the Sun, how come we can't observe Jupiter-like extrasolar planets directly using radio telescopes?
Right. It's true that Jupiter sometimes flares up and gives off bright radio emission. And at those times, Jupiter is as bright as the Sun at some radio frequencies. However, both Jupiter and the Sun are pretty faint radio sources compared to other things. The bright radio objects giving off lots of radio emission that we see with the telescopes aren't normal stars or planets. Either they're much bigger, sort of clouds of plasma or hydrogen gas or dust that are as big as the solar system or even bigger. Or they have much stronger magnetic fields, so some types of young stars or collapsed dead stars, or the disks around big black holes. The other problem is that Jupiter's bright emission is at very low frequencies, the lowest possible frequencies, that radio frequencies that can get through the atmosphere. And those are lower than the frequencies that are mostly used by the big radio telescopes. So even when it's flaring, Jupiter's still a little bit too faint, and the frequency's too low, and with current instruments we couldn't see Jupiter if it was around another star. There have been a few searches directed at known extrasolar planets that have been detected with other techniques, and just in case they're a little bit brighter than Jupiter in the radio or emit at slightly higher frequencies, but so far they've come up negative.
So it's a combination of the fact that Jupiter is, although it's producing a lot of radio emission and can produce radio emission brighter than the Sun at radio frequencies, it's still, relatively speaking, a weak radio source.
Yeah, it's still, relatively speaking, a weak radio source. Like, the bright radio sources are things other than normal stars or planets going around those stars. There is a little bit of hope for the future, because there are some, in the near future, there are some new low-frequency radio telescopes being built. And these include LOFAR in Europe, the Murchison Wide Field Array in Australia, and the Long Wavelength Array in the United States. So they'll be very sensitive down at frequencies of, 30 to 100 megahertz, which is where, and then 100 to 200 megahertz, where you might get emission from a planet. And also they're going to monitor a big patch of the sky all at once, so that even if a planet only sends out bright radio emission for a short time, that sort of continuous monitoring of a big area of sky could catch it if it was somewhere in that area of the sky. So, those instruments will be up and running at their sort of, well, some of them they're operating already with a few antennas, but they'll be up and running at full power within 2 to 5 years. And so there's, a reasonable chance that they'll detect some extrasolar planets glowing in the radio if they're just a little bit brighter than Jupiter.
Well, that's interesting. We should look forward to the results coming from those experiments.
Yes.
Now, the next question, again from Tom Hubbardson, is this. I believe that the refractive effect of the Earth's atmosphere is such that when the Sun appears to be on an observer's horizon, geometrically it would actually be some fraction below. This must mean that the Sun is able to illuminate over half of the Earth at any one time. So the question is, taking this refractive process into account, how much of the Earth's surface is illuminated at any one time?
Right, so it's true that the Sun can actually illuminate a little bit more than half of the Earth's surface, and there are actually two effects that contribute to that. Firstly, the Sun isn't just a point source, it's actually spread out over half a degree on the sky. So even if the centre of the disk goes below the horizon, you still have the top of the disk poking up over the horizon and staying visible for, a little bit longer. And also, as Tom says, refraction bends the light from the Sun, and it actually moves the image a little bit higher in the sky. So, if any bit of the Sun seems to be sitting right on the horizon, its geometric position, the straight line to that position, would actually go down below the horizon. And the amount of that refraction is 34 arc minutes, so the geometric position of the Sun is 34 arc minutes below the horizon if some bit of the Sun appears to be on the horizon. So when you put those two effects together, when we see the last bit of the Sun setting on the horizon, the geometric position of the centre of the Sun is actually 50 arc minutes below the horizon, which is equivalent to 5/6 of a degree, so 5/6 of a degree. And so when you calculate the little bit of extra area of the Earth that gets illuminated by the Sun because of that, you find that the Sun actually illuminates 50.7% of the Earth's surface at any time, not 50.0%.
Right. That's fantastic. Thank you very much for working that out for us.
Well, and of course, I suppose I'm not worrying about things like, reflections off clouds or those sorts of issues, because that would change.
We'll keep it simple.
Even in terms of, where you would get direct sunlight without clouds, it's that fraction.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for that. Okay, now the next question is from Stephen Wheatie, and he writes, We hear that when two galaxies pass through each other, that even though the stars themselves don't collide, the gas and dust does. Does this cause star formation, or is the gas and dust too hot? Momentum is conserved, and the average momentum of the gas may not match either galaxy, leaving it between them. So does this gas and dust, and any stars formed, leave both galaxies?
So the answer is essentially yes to both questions. The collision of two galaxies does send shocks through their gas and dust, and when those shocks compress the gas, it often forms new stars. And sometimes the gas and the new stars end up between the two original galaxies or stretched out in some, you know, stream or long filament or loop outside the original galaxies. And those often show up quite differently because the new stars are younger and you get the very largest, youngest stars which send out a lot of blue light, and then the older stars in the original galaxy shine more in red light. So you can see a real offset between the new stars and the old stars. And there are some spectacular images of this from the Hubble Space Telescope.
Next question is, the gas and dust in a galaxy forms the interstellar medium. Can the interstellar medium be replenished by stellar winds and supernovae? If so, how long does it take?
So the interstellar medium does get replenished by stellar winds and by supernovae. So stars send out little bits of matter throughout their lives, which is called the stellar wind. And then, right at the end of their lives, when they explode a supernova, that throws off huge chunks of matter into the interstellar medium. So a lot of the star's material, even a majority for some stars, ends up back in the interstellar space where it came from. Because of nuclear fusion in the star, a lot of the original hydrogen and helium gets converted to heavier elements. Stars enrich the ISM with more complex materials. Most of the mass loss from a star happens at the end of its life in that big supernova explosion. So the time scale to put enriched material into the interstellar medium is the star's lifetime. That's tens of millions of years for large stars and billions of years for solar mass stars. For stars that are much lighter than the sun, it would take hundreds of billions of years. So it hasn't happened yet.
Right. So most stars are replenishing the ISM with a constant, you know, gentle stellar wind. And for some stars, at the end of their life, there is a spectacular explosion and it blows off a lot of matter out into the ISM.
Yes, that's right.
Last question is, can current computer modeling of these interactions take into account gas and dust?
So yes, computer simulations can handle gas and dust, but it takes a lot more time and computing power than if you don't worry about those effects. So sometimes the models will include parts of the interactions, the gas and dust interactions at small scales, and ignore it on large scales where it is dominated by the gravity. So an example of that might be if you have sort of separate clusters of galaxies, they only interact with each other by gravity. But then within those clusters, you have to worry about the complex gas and dust physics. So you only put in that non-gravitational physics when you have to.
Yes, yes. Right, well, thank you very much indeed for answering the questions this episode.
Oh, thank you, Nick. It was good to be in, and you're welcome. I hope to get to do it maybe one last time before I finish up here.
Of course. So if anybody out there has got questions for our astronomers, please do submit them at our website, www.jodcast.net.